Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 15th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows Donald Trump. He is sitting in a golden throne. He's got a determined look on his face, and right hand lifted and fist in the air. He's being carried by a mob of screaming supporters. I guess they're happy, but they have angry looks about them. A lot of men, a lot of MAGA caps, some women and people of color. You can see the Capitol building in the background, and the sky has some ominous dark clouds. The headline is America's Choice: Why a Divided Nation Swung for Trump Again. That is our first main story. We will start right there. Trump returns to power with sweeping victory. What happened? Donald Trump was decisively elected the nation's 47th president this week, reclaiming the White House despite multiple indictments, a criminal conviction, and accusations of authoritarianism. The stunning comeback by the 45th president followed weeks of polls that showed the nation's seven swing states in a virtual dead heat, and wide expectation that Vice President Kamala Harris would benefit from a surge of support from women angered at the erosion of abortion rights. But Trump, 78, won in Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and as the week went to press, was leading in Arizona and Nevada, putting a sweep of battlegrounds within reach. Having lost the popular vote in 2016 and 20, Trump looked likely to win it after besting his 2020 numbers in one state and one demographic after another, including with women, Latino voters, and black voters. In Florida and Texas, he improved on his 2020 figures by 10 percentage points, in New York by 13 points. "We overcame obstacles that nobody thought possible," Trump said in his victory speech. Exit polling showed Trump drew voters with his promises to seal the southern border, cut taxes, and boost the economy. On the stump, he told repeated falsehoods about violent migrants overrunning communities, blaming President Biden's border policies, and drew cheers by vowing to round up millions of illegal migrants in camps and deport them. In the week leading up to the election, he said he'd let conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. go wild on health in his administration, mimed oral sex with a microphone, called Harris a low IQ individual and dumb as a rock, and said he'd like to see nine-barrel shooting at his critic Liz Cheney, a former Republican congresswoman. After calling Trump to congratulate him on his win, Harris spoke to a crowd at her alma mater, Howard University. "While I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign," she said. "The fight for freedom, for opportunity, for fairness, and the dignity of all people." In his victory speech, Trump called himself the leader of the greatest political movement of all time, adding that he will govern by a simple motto: promises made, promises kept. What the editorial said: Trump has staged a political comeback for the ages, said the Wall Street Journal. After he incited the U.S. Capitol riot on January 6, 2021, he was all but written off. Democrats helped to revive him with their politicized prosecutions and partisan January 6 investigation. But what really opened the door was Biden's failure to deliver the unity and prosperity he promised. He ran through overambitious spending programs that spiked inflation and let the border devolve into chaos. Harris tried to pitch herself as a new way forward, but fed-up voters weren't buying. America has made a perilous choice, said the New York Times, setting the nation on a precarious course that no one can fully foresee. Trump has made crystal clear who he is, an aspiring autocrat with no respect for the law or the norms and traditions of democracy, who will use the military against political foes he calls the enemy within. Over the next 4 years, Americans must be clear-eyed about the threat he poses and ready to exercise their rights in defense of the country and the people, laws, institutions, and values that have kept it strong. What the columnist said. Trump shocked the world with a sweeping victory, said Harry Lampert in the Daily Beast. An exit poll show how he did it. He made gains with women. Harris won them by only 10 points, 2.5 less than Biden in 2020. Trump did 16 point better with Hispanics than in 2020, and 33 points better with Hispanic men, while cutting Democrats' edge with black voters by 9 points. Polled voters spoke of frustration with their finances and persistent gloom about the state of the country, said Stephanie Perry in NBCNews.com. They wanted change, and 7 in 10 said it was Trump who could deliver it. It's easy to see why voters put their faith in this colossus, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. Trump was impeached twice, indicted 91 times in 3 criminal courts, convicted of 34 felonies, targeted twice by would-be assassins, and bombarded with hostile press coverage. But he refused to be bent or broken. And as the bumbling Biden created both an economic crisis and a border crisis, Trump spoke straight to the American people about the mess we are in, and they responded. When Trump won in 2016, American voters knew to his character had a sliver of plausible deniability, said Christina Cotarucci in Slate. This time, there are no excuses. Americans saw the chaos of his first administration and saw him incite a violent mob to try to overturn the 2020 election. They heard his crude, racist, and bizarre talk on the stump and his vows to weaponize the government against his enemies. And they enthusiastically handed the government to a man they well know is ready to tear it down. Trump will now return to the White House older, less inhibited, and far more dangerous than ever before, said Susan B. Glasser in The New Yorker. As he pursues an authoritarian agenda, he'll be unconstrained by the sober-headed establishment Republicans who served as guardrails in his first term, and will get no opposition from compliant congressional Republicans. "We're not going back," was the rallying cry at Harris campaign events. But with Trump triumphant, the question is not if we are going back, but how far. Controversy of the week. Democrats. Why Harris lost so badly. Now that Donald Trump has trounced Kamala Harris, the blame game among Democrats will come fast and furious, said Andrew Prokop, in Box. But considering the stunning extent of Trump's victory, you have to wonder, did Harris ever stand a chance? Since the COVID pandemic ended, incumbent parties in wealthy democracies have taken electoral beatings, largely because of inflation created by the pandemic itself. As the incumbent vice president under the historically unpopular Joe Biden, Harris couldn't avoid blame for the surge in prices and migration that followed the pandemic's end. Thanks to Biden's decision to run for re-election until a disastrous debate forced him from the race, Harris was left only 107 days to present herself to voters as a new face, assuage their concerns about inflation and immigration, and help voters understand the threat posed by Donald Trump. She faced an uphill battle all around. "Women always do in this country," said Jill Filipovich in Slate. Trump ran a campaign of almost cartoonish misogyny, but we can't blame this result entirely on sexism. Voter concerns about immigration and inflation are very real. Still, it should not surprise us that Americans have once again rejected a woman candidate and elected a male president, extending an unbroken masculine chain more than two centuries long. Harris was only able to run a short campaign, said George F. Will in the Washington Post, but it proved too long for her talents. In speeches, Harris segued from vapidity, joy, to hysteria, fascism, while in interviews she came off as defensive and insecure, and too often found herself lost in syntactical labyrinths. Harris' most disastrous interview may have been her friendliest, said Joey Garrison in USA Today. Asked by the fawning host of ABC's The View what she would do differently from Biden, Harris replied, "Not a thing that comes to mind." Why would she say that, given that about 70% of the electorate has consistently told pollsters the country is on the wrong track? In the end, the fatal flaw of Harris' campaign was to remain tethered to Biden in voters' minds. Harris and progressives simply did not understand how toxic Biden had become, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. Cocooned in their own media echo chamber, Democrats insisted voters were wrong to blame Biden for several years of inflation and for the massive surge of asylum seekers crossing the southern border. Yes, Harris tried to move to the center on these issues, but failed to convince voters she'd been transformed from the far-left California liberal who ran in the 2020 presidential primary. Trump's most effective ad of the cycle spotlighted Harris' previous support for free sex change surgery for prison inmates, said Matt Bai in the Washington Post. The Democratic Party's embrace of the left's gender ideology, including trans athletes competing against girls and women, and the use of they-them pronouns, are big turnoffs to working-class voters, including Hispanics. Harris lost largely because Democrats have dug themselves into a hole on cultural issues and identity politics. At least it wasn't close, said Freddie DeBoer in his Substack newsletter. Had Harris lost narrowly, Democrats would focus on a scapegoat: Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin, Elon Musk, podcast bros, and waste 4 years lamenting what might have been. The upside of a defeat this sweeping is that you have to actually figure out what's wrong with your party. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Elon Musk, whose wealth soared by more than $15 billion after Donald Trump's election win sent Tesla stock rocketing. Now worth an estimated $280 billion, Musk saw a better than 12,000% return on the $119 million he donated to help Trump win the White House. It was a good week for walking here after New York City legalized jaywalking, the practice of crossing the street without regard to crosswalks or traffic signals, was banned in 1958, and its legalization will free police to focus on true public safety efforts, said New York City Council member Mercedes Narcisse. It's a good week for privacy after a Singaporean court granted a partial domestic exclusion order to a man whose adult sister, against his will, has been cleaning his bedroom in their shared home for the past 8 years. It was not necessary for the sister to impose her own hygiene standards on her brother, ruled the judge. But it was a bad week for the infinite monkey theorem, after Australian mathematicians calculated that if all 200,000 of the world's chimpanzees were chained to typewriters and made immortal, they would fail to produce the complete works of Shakespeare or even any non-trivial written work before the expected heat death of the universe in many, many years. It was a bad week for sweet dreams after former Fox News host Tucker Carlson revealed in a new documentary that he was physically mauled by a demon while in bed 18 months ago. The assault left him bleeding from claw marks on his sides, he said, No one has to believe me, but that happened to me. And it was a bad week for cheeseheads. After 24 tons of rare cheddar, worth about $390,000, was stolen from a top London cheese store. Celebrity chef Jamie Oliver asked Brits to stay on the lookout for the loot, saying if they hear about posh cheese going for cheap, it's probably some wrong'uns. The title of the briefing this week is The Problem with Plastic. Most plastic waste can't be turned into new products. Is it time to give up on recycling? How much plastic do we toss out? The U.S. generates about 48 million tons of plastic trash every year. Globally, the figure is estimated at 400 million tons. And only a tiny share of the plastic bottles, bags, packaging that we use gets recycled. Worldwide, about 9% of that waste is transformed into new items. In the U.S., it's 5 to 6%. The rest is dumped in landfills or incinerated, or ends up littering oceans, beaches, and other parts of the landscape where this hardy material, it takes at least 400 years to decompose, fragments into smaller pieces known as microplastics. Those plastic particulates have been found in Arctic snow, the air we breathe, and the water we drink. The dismal recycling figures aren't due to lack of will or low compliance with recycling mandates, but because recycling plastic is inherently problematic. Most plastics are not recyclable, said Judith Ink, a former EPA administrator and president of the advocacy group Beyond Plastics. And you know who has known this for years? The companies that make and sell plastic. Why is it hard to recycle? Plastic, which is made from fossil fuels, comes in hundreds of varieties. An orange Tide jug and a clear Pepsi bottle contain different polymers, chemical additives, and colorants that can't be recycled together. That makes sorting out the many types of plastic and melting them down expensive and energy intensive. Plastic also degrades each time it is reused, and so sturdy bottles and containers are typically downcycled into lower-grade products such as trash bags. Only about 1% of the plastics ever produced have been recycled twice. It is cheaper to just make a new plastic product than to collect it and recycle it or reuse it, said Christian Seiberg, who studies plastic pollution at Roskilde University in Denmark. That's a systematic problem. Critics of plastic recycling say the roots of that problem go back to the 1950s, when the plastic sector embraced a growth strategy that has helped turn it into a $700 billion industry. What was the new strategy? Turning plastic into a disposable good. For the first half of the 20th century, the new plastics created by chemists were mostly used to craft durable products. Bakelite replaced wood in radios, for example, and polyethylene Tupperware replaced glass and ceramic containers. But in 1956, modern packaging editor Lloyd Stouffer told an industry conference that the future of plastic is in the trash can. For plastic sales to really boom, he argued, the industry should focus on single-use plastic bottles, jugs, tubes, and other packaging. The idea caught on, and by 1963, Stouffer was celebrating that the happy day has arrived when nobody considers the package too good to throw away. Plastic production exploded, going from 1.7 million tons in 1950 to 110 million in 1989. As plastic swamped landfills and piled up on streets, it fueled a public backlash. Facing threats of state and federal regulation, the industry landed on a solution: promote recycling. How did it push that message? In 1984, petrochemical companies and bottlers formed the Plastics Recycling Foundation. The trade group rolled out the Three Arrows recyclable logo, lobbied governments to create curbside recycling programs, and launched ad campaigns. A bottle can come back as a bottle over and over again, read one. But documents and statements by former industry executives reveal this was done with full knowledge of recycling's limitations. Recycling plastic is costly and infeasible, wrote scientists in an industry-commissioned report in 1973. At a 1994 trade meeting, an executive with oil giant ExxonMobil, the world's largest producer of plastic polymers, said a common form of chemical recycling was a fundamentally uneconomical process. In September, California Attorney General Rob Bonta filed a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against ExxonMobil, alleging the company waged a decades-long campaign of deception on plastic recycling. The company led consumers to believe recycling could solve the plastic waste crisis, said Bonta, even though it clearly knew this wasn't possible. How has the industry responded? Exxon says California is simply trying to blame others for the state's ineffective recycling system, and the industry as a whole is pushing back on efforts by states and local governments to phase out single-use plastics, saying that a new process known as advanced recycling will be able to handle all plastic waste. In advanced recycling, heat or solvents are used to break down plastics to its basic molecular building block, which can then be made into virgin-grade plastic. The industry is on the cusp of a circularity revolution, said the American Chemistry Council lobbying group. But Jennifer Congdon of Beyond Plastic said much of what's produced in advanced recycling isn't new plastic, but rather fuel to be burned. It's like a fancy way to incinerate without saying that you're using an incinerator, she said. Congdon and other critics also point out that the industry has spent millions of dollars on advanced recycling plants that have either closed or are operating at a small fraction of their touted capacity. Meanwhile, global plastic production, which doubled over the past 20 years, is on track to nearly quadruple by 2050. There's only one solution to that looming wave of trash, said Inc., making less plastic. Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Why Bezos should sell the Post. To ensure its independence, Jeff Bezos should donate the Washington Post to a public charity, said Stephen Waldman. Until his recent last-minute decision to kill the newspaper's endorsement of Kamala Harris, the Amazon mogul was an admirable newspaper owner who kept his opinions to himself while letting editors make the journalism decisions. Now, though, he is simply too financially compromised to maintain the Post's credibility. Amazon and his spaceflight company, Blue Origin, are deeply dependent on federal regulation and dollars, which makes Bezos vulnerable to political punishment for what his newspaper publishes. When he was president, Donald Trump retaliated against Bezos by ordering the Pentagon to deny Amazon Web Services a $10 billion contract. To protect his reputation and that of the Post, Bezos should now set up a foundation with an independent board to run the paper and add a $100 million donation to get the new arrangement rolling. The owners of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Tampa Bay Times have overseen similar transitions. Bezos would go from embattled corporate censor to an Andrew Carnegie-like national benefactor, and ensure the survival of one of the most important news outlets in America. How charters weed out bad schools. Not all charter schools succeed, but there is an unexpected upside when they closed, said Emma Camp. New research published by the National Center for Charter School Accountability shows that 1 in 4 public charter schools shutter within 5 years of opening. While these closures can be destabilizing to students and their families, it is also a positive sign that market factors are effectively ensuring educational quality. Traditional public schools can stay open forever with guaranteed public funding in spite of terrible performance in educating students. But charters face strong parental pressure to succeed, and those that don't perform well are weeded out fairly quickly by enrollment declines. For that, we should be glad. The closure of mediocre charters frees up families to support better alternatives, including new charter schools and private school or homeschool voucher programs. As a whole, the country's 7,800 charter schools are a wildly successful alternative to local public schools, especially in poor neighborhoods where students have been neglected for decades. That success comes from giving families a choice and allowing competition to improve educational quality. This column comes from Europe. Not yet serious about global leadership. When American presidents take office, their new foreign defense and treasury secretaries are sworn in within weeks, regardless of which party controls the Senate, said Hubert Wetzel. America being a global superpower, its leaders know they can't afford a paralyzing interregnum after an election. Why doesn't the EU, which has superpower pretensions, feel a similar sense of urgency? Ursula von der Leyen was reelected as head of the European Commission in July, but thanks to our tedious slog of a confirmation process, the 26 commissioners she chose for her second term won't roll up their sleeves and get to work until December at the earliest. And that's assuming no parliamentary faction takes a dislike to one of her picks. This is not good for Europe. The global political situation is hardly rosy right now, with war in the Middle East, Sudan, and Europe itself, and both China and North Korea rumbling aggressively. The fallout from the bare-knuckles presidential battle in the U.S. will reverberate for months to come, yet the EU's top positions continue to be filled by lame-duck placeholders. Had the European Parliament acted with a little more urgency, we would have had new EU leadership in place before the American election. Instead, Europe remains effectively muzzled, just when it should be leading the global defense of democracy. And it's time for the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, Their Son Died, Then the Hate Came. When 11-year-old Aiden Clark was killed in a school bus crash, his parents didn't think to blame it on immigration, said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. But others did. Springfield, Ohio. Sheriff's deputy arrived at Nathan and Danielle Clark's front door on the outskirts of Springfield last month with the latest memento of what their son's death had become. "I'm sorry that I have to show you this," she said, and handed them a flyer with a picture of Aiden, 11, smiling at the camera after his last baseball game. It was the same image that Clark's had chosen for his funeral program and then made into Christmas ornaments for his classmates. But this time, the photograph was printed alongside threats and racial slurs. "Killed by a Haitian invader," the flyer read. "They didn't care about Aiden. They don't care about you. They are pieces of human trash that deserve not your sympathy, but utter scorn. Give it to them, and then some." Nathan reached into his pocket and squeezed a piece of Aiden's old blanket that he kept with him to help stave off panic attacks. "They have no right to speak for him like this," Danielle said. "It's making me sick. There must be some way to stop it." "We're checking the flyers for fingerprints," the deputy said. "They put them online and drop them off all over the neighborhood. It's awful. It's grotesque." "Once upon a time, it would have surprised me," Nathan said. "But nothing's off limits anymore. We keep hitting new lows." This was the version of the country the Clarks and their two teenage children had encountered during the last year. Ever since Aiden died in a school bus crash in August 2023 on the way to his first day of sixth grade, the crash was ruled an accident caused by a legally registered Haitian immigrant who veered into the bus while driving without a valid license. But as the presidential campaign intensified, former President Donald Trump and his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, began to tell a different story. They said Aiden's death was a murder committed by an illegal as part of a border bloodbath in another American community that had been invaded, conquered, and taken over by migrant criminals from the dungeons of the Third World. In the past 5 years, as many as 20,000 Haitian immigrants have moved to Springfield, a town of about 60,000. The bus accident became a flashpoint at city meetings, where pain and frustration about the city's shifting demographics turned to anger. And the anger often escalated into fear-mongering and racism that puts Springfield at the epicenter of a contentious election. All of it was antithetical to what the Clarks believed and to the compassion they'd admired most in their son. "Please stop the hate," Nathan had said at a city meeting in September. But instead, some of that hatred had turned back against them. Icy stares from neighbors, cruel Facebook messages, the public doxing of their phone number, letters about being immigrant-loving race traitors, and a recent death threat relayed by the FBI. "The best thing you can do is stay out of the city," the sheriff's deputy told them. She said the Proud Boys had another march scheduled for the upcoming weekend. During the last few months in Springfield, there had been acts of vandalism at Haitian churches and more than 30 bomb threats that evacuated municipal buildings, forced the city's hospitals into lockdown, and required state troopers to stand guard in front of local elementary schools. "We're setting up 24-hour protection for you," the deputy said. "We'll leave a car stationed in front of the house." They had done everything they could to preserve Aiden's presence within the house since the accident, leaving the decorative red lights on in his bedroom and his sandals perched at the top of the stairs, just as Aiden had done when he rushed out to the bus. That was his zucchini replanted in the garden, his handwriting tattooed on their forearms, and his ashes stored inside a custom-made soccer ball in the living room, where they'd often warned him about throwing balls and playing outdoor sports inside. At the same time, the rest of Springfield was memorializing Aiden, too. More than 1,500 people came to his funeral, many of whom the Clarks didn't know, and dozens of people began lining up to speak on his behalf during the public comment session at city meetings. They said they wanted justice for Aiden, retribution for Aiden, enhanced traffic enforcement for Aiden, increased police presence for Aiden, English-only signs at Walmart for Aiden, workplace immigration raids for Aiden, mass deportations for Aiden, to take Springfield back for Aiden, none of which reflected what the Clarks wanted or believed. They had worked hard to seek out diversity in rural Ohio. Danielle taught kindergarten on the outskirts of Dayton, at a low-income elementary school where her students were black, white, Hispanic, Ukrainian, and increasingly Haitian, and where she specialized in working with children who had multiple disabilities. Nathan taught fourth grade in a nearby farming community transformed by a new wave of Turkish immigrants. And as cultural tensions reverberated through the town, he requested to have Turkish students placed in his class. He put a sign above his classroom, Talking Turk, and asked the students to teach him a new word each week. When he started to notice large groups of Haitian immigrants moving into Springfield a few years ago, he signed up for Duolingo to learn phrases in French and Haitian Creole. He wrote to a friend in city government, asking if he knew of any summer jobs teaching English to Haitians. "I'm pretty sure I can help," Nathan wrote. It wasn't until a few days after the crash that Nathan and Danielle learned that the driver, Hermanio Joseph, was also an immigrant, a Haitian who had flown to South America and had crossed in 22 from Mexico into Texas, where he'd requested asylum and been released into the United States with temporary protected status. The Clarks were angry about many things after the accident, that Joseph had been driving with an invalid Mexican license, that he was seemingly tired or distracted on his way home from the graveyard shift at an Ohio manufacturing plant, that his minivan crossed over the center line as he went around a curve, that his recklessness forced the school bus off the road down an embankment and onto its side, that prosecutors said his maximum sentence for involuntary manslaughter was only 11 years, but it never occurred to the Clarks to extend their anger onto an entire population of immigrants. "Let us grieve in peace. Take his picture down," Nathan wrote in a comment on Instagram after Trump's campaign posted a photo of Aiden, which it never took down. "We do not want our son's name associated with the uninformed majority that vocalized their hate," he said at Joseph's trial. And when none of that changed the discourse, Nathan called the one politician he still trusted most, Rob Rue, the Republican mayor of Springfield, who also ran a local funeral home. It was Rue who had brought in a restorative mortician from Cincinnati to work on Aiden after the accident, and then given the Clarks full access to his funeral home so they could sit at Aiden's side, touching his hair and holding his hand for the better part of 3 days, because they couldn't stand the idea of leaving him there alone. Rue knew as well as anyone how much they had suffered. So when Nathan asked in early September if he could make his first statement at a city meeting, Rue offered to bring the Clarks into the building through a private entrance and then called them to the podium first. "I wish that my son, Aiden Clark, was killed by a 60-year-old white man," Nathan said that day as Danielle stood next to him. "I bet you never thought anyone would ever say something so blunt. But if that guy killed my 11-year-old son, the incessant group of hate-spewing people would leave us alone. They make it seem as though our wonderful Aiden appreciates their hate, that we should follow their hate. This needs to stop now." A police officer led them toward the exit as more speakers lined up behind the microphone. "Are they going to take over our whole city?" the next speaker said. "We should have a no vacancy sign up right now. The diseases, the crime, they are using our community as a dumping ground," someone else said. But by then the Clarks were back in the car on their way home. The school bus traveled through Nathan and Danielle's imaginations a dozen times each day as they traced over the last hours of Aiden's life. He was always nervous about transitions like the first day of school, so he'd spent the previous evening prolonging his last hours of summer, lying on the trampoline in the backyard with his 15-year-old sister, Madeline, playing video games with his 19-year-old brother, Preston, shooting water guns in the yard with Nathan, lounging on the couch with Danielle until bedtime. His anxiety sometimes turned into stomach aches and trouble sleeping, but Nathan sat on his bed and reassured him. He was a straight-A student. His classmates adored him. He loved going to school. There was nothing to worry about. Standing inside the Clark's living room was the sheriff's deputy they knew best, John Loney, a school resource officer who had been one of the first people to arrive at the crash that morning. He'd accompanied the Clarks to support them during the funeral and the trial, and now he'd come to retrieve one of the dozens of racist flyers that had been dropped off in their neighborhood, so he could help with that investigation. He told them he'd spent the morning downtown, tracking white supremacist groups as they marched with Nazi flags to the mayor's house and chanted about Haitians and crime and savagery. It was more of the same, Loney said. That's every weekend now. It gets to a point where you start to lose faith in the goodness of people, Nathan said. I know what you mean, Loney said. He told them how a few white supremacists had gone to the accident site to film a video, and they'd shared lies about the crash online. It burns me because that place should be sacred, Loney said. His voice broke, and he paused to catch his breath. I'm sorry, he said. I have no right to get emotional compared to you guys, but it pisses me off. It should, Danielle said. It's personal. You were there. Those were the hardest hours of my life, Loney said, and they began to talk about the morning of the crash. Loney told Danielle and Nathan about how he arrived a few minutes after the crash and noticed backpacks in the road, water bottles, broken glass, and finally two students who had been ejected when the bus rolled and then caught under the roof. One was a girl who survived her injuries, and the other was Aiden, who was already dead. Me and another deputy, we went and sat with him on the grass, Loney said. Oh, Aiden, Danielle said. Oh, God. I held his hand, Loney said. I made sure nothing touched him. I talked to him and told him that I wasn't going to leave. A fire crew arrived and said the position of the bus was unstable. They asked Loney and his partner to move for their own safety, but they refused. They stayed in place for more than an hour until the coroner came, and then they carried Aiden into the van. For a long time, I wondered if I was being punished for something, Loney said. To see this little boy on the first day of school, it broke something in me. But in a way, I'm grateful. You stayed, Danielle said, still making sense of it. You stayed right there with him. It speaks to your character, Nathan said. It was nothing. It was basic, Loney said. But Nathan reached over and squeezed his shoulder, trying to make him understand. In the moments that haunted them most, someone had responded to their son's death, not with callousness or self-interest or fear, but with compassion, with decency. That matters to us, Nathan said. Right now, it matters more than anything. A longer version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Once again, I'm going to read both of the obituaries. A lot of interesting folks have passed lately. First up, the musical giant who spanned genres and generations. Quincy Jones, 1933 to 2024. The wonder of Quincy Jones, U2 frontman Bono once said, is that one man could fit so much music into one lifetime. Over a seven-decade career, Jones compiled a staggering resume, shining as a performer, composer, arranger, and producer, and working with hundreds of artists across a genre from bebop to soul, bubblegum pop to rap. He played trumpet with Count Basie, arranged records for Frank Sinatra, wrote film scores, and produced Ray Charles, Luther Vandross, Lena Horne, and Snoop Dogg. Nominated for 80 Grammys, he won 28, he produced We Are the World, the 1985 charity record featuring a who's who of A-list musicians. His top commercial triumph was producing a trilogy of Michael Jackson albums, including Thriller, a global juggernaut that sold over 75 million copies. Such achievements earned Jones a Bel Air mansion and an estimated $400 million fortune. But he insisted he'd never done anything just for commercial reward. Not even Thriller, he said in 2018. God walks out of the room when you start thinking about money. Born in Chicago during the Depression, Jones was obsessed with all forms of music from an early age, said the Wall Street Journal. His carpenter father struggled to put food on the table, and he and his siblings sometimes ate rats fried by their grandmother. His mother, a schizophrenic, was institutionalized when he was seven, and the traumatized boy began running with a gang. But he had a revelation at 11, when he and some friends broke into a recreation center and saw a piano. Playing a few notes, he began to find peace, he later wrote. I knew this was it for me, forever. At school, he was recognized as a musical prodigy, said the Washington Post. He learned drums, tuba, French horn, and piano, but focused on the trumpet. After briefly attending what's now the Berklee College of Music in Boston, he left a tour with Dizzy Gillespie. As Jones' visibility escalated, said the Los Angeles Times, he was soon arranging for stars including Basie, Duke Ellington, and Sarah Vaughan. He moved to Paris, where he studied composition and started his own big band. But after a tour ran into financial problems, he grew tired of scraping by. And in 1961, he took a job as New York musical director for Mercury Records. He found immediate pop success, said the Times UK, producing the number one Leslie Gore hit, It's My Party. More hits followed, and a promotion made him the first black major label executive. But he shifted gears after director Sidney Lumet drafted him to compose the score for The Pawnbroker, 1964. And buoyed by the film's success, he relocated to Los Angeles. Over the next three decades, he scored more than 30 films, including In Cold Blood and The Color Purple, and wrote the theme music for TV shows such as Ironside and Sanford and Son. Jones' collaboration with Jackson grew out of his work on the soundtrack for the 1978 film The Wiz, said Rolling Stone. Jackson's label resisted, calling Jones too jazzy. But Jackson insisted, and the result was one of the most fruitful musical partnerships in history. On Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad, Jones paired Jackson with crack musicians and songwriters and the most modern musical technology. The result was stunningly sophisticated, rhythmically explosive hits such as Beat It and Billie Jean that made Jackson a worldwide megastar. Jones' own profile was further lifted by We Are the World, which went multi-platinum. In later years, Jones helmed a multimedia empire, said the New York Times. His entertainment company ran a record label, produced the sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and published the hip-hop magazine Vibe. A self-described dog who juggled lovers around the world, he married three times and fathered seven children by five mothers. When he wasn't hanging out with presidents, movie stars, or Nobel laureates, he dedicated much of his time to charity work through his Listen Up Foundation aimed at disadvantaged youth. The experiences I've had, he said in 2018, you almost can't believe it. The comic actress who lent dignity to ditzes. Terry Garr, 1944 to 2024. With her sensitive blue eyes and her expert comic timing, Terry Garr turned dumb blonde roles into characters of poignancy and depth. Often, as in Young Frankenstein, 1974, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1977, and After Hours, 1985, she played women who had to deal with unpredictable men. But she was more than a foil. She combined vulnerability with deadpan humor even as her characters were melting down, as in the sudden, shrieking tantrum of a jilted lover she gave in Tootsie, 1982, which earned her an Oscar nomination. A favorite on late-night TV, Garr hosted Saturday Night Live three times and was a frequent guest of Johnny Carson and David Letterman. Yet despite widespread accolades for comedic talent, she struggled to find suitable roles. Women are not taken seriously, she said in 2008. If there's ever a woman who's smart, funny, or witty, people are afraid of that, so they don't write that. Born in Los Angeles, Terry Ann Garr was the daughter of Roquette and Vaudevillian. Her father died when she was 11. She started out studying ballet, making her professional debut as a dancer right after high school. Once she started making money from commercials, she dropped out of college. She began getting work in films, mostly as uncredited backup dancer, and appeared in multiple Elvis Presley movies. Yet playing showgirls and go-go dancers was less satisfying than she'd hoped, said the New York Times. Gar wanted to act. She booked a few speaking roles, appearing on Star Trek and the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, but she really gained attention as the German lab assistant in Young Frankenstein, said Variety, where her first line was the memorable, "Would you like to have a role in the hay?" The last part of her career was a lot like the beginning, said NPR.org, with small roles on big TV shows like Friends. After years of inexplicable pain and muscle weakness, Gar was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1999 and became a spokesperson for MS Research, making appearances in her wheelchair. She suffered a brain aneurysm in 2006, spending a week in a coma before relearning to walk and talk. "I really do count my blessings," she wrote in a 2005 memoir. "At least I used to. Now I get so tired I have a woman come once a week and count them for me." And just enough time left for some shorter pieces. We'll take a couple from the Health and Science page. The mass extinction of Earth's trees. More than a third of the world's tree species are at risk of going extinct, according to a comprehensive new report. The assessment, known as the Red List, covered 80% of all known species and was carried out by more than 1,000 experts for the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the world's leading scientific authority on the issue. It found that 38% of species are under threat, with island varieties like Madagascar's roadwoods and Borneo's giant dipterocarps facing the highest risk because they have small, isolated populations. In temperate regions, pests and diseases are a growing problem, while climate change is an intensifying threat everywhere. But the main underlying stressor, of course, is humans. Worldwide, agriculture and logging are the biggest drivers of species loss, followed by urbanization. At the UN Climate Conference in 2021, more than 140 countries pledged to halt deforestation by the end of this decade. But the rate of tree loss is currently 45% above where it needs to be to meet that target. These findings are particularly sobering because trees and forests are crucial for regulating the planet's flows of water, nutrients, and carbon. Trees directly underpin the survival of so many species. David Hole from Conservation International's Moore Center for Science tells CBSNews.com, "Without biodiverse ecosystems that include healthy and diverse tree populations, the world will face an even greater climate threat than the one we are already facing." A vast Mayan city. Archaeologists have discovered an ancient Maya city by examining old forest surveys of Mexico, reports Smithsonian. The ruined city, named Valeriana, after a nearby lagoon, is in the southeastern state of Campeche, an area with several other Maya settlements. It appears to have been one of the most densely populated centers in ancient Latin America, supporting up to 50,000 people. The researchers found evidence of more than 6,500 structures, as well as several enclosed plazas, causeways connecting different districts, a ball court where people played games with rubber balls, temple pyramids, amphitheaters, and a freshwater reservoir. Founded before AD 150, the settlement likely flourished during the Classic period between roughly 250 and 900. Lead author Luke Auld Thomas from Northern Arizona University discovered the city after coming across a 2013 environmental survey that used LIDAR, a remote sensing technology that can map structures buried beneath vegetation. "The government never knew about it. The scientific community never knew about it," he says. "It's right next to the area's only highway, near a town where people have been actively farming among the ruins for years. And a couple short notes from the Talking Points page. A record high of at least 170 Native American, Native Alaskan, and Native Hawaiian candidates appeared on ballots on Election Day. There are currently 347 Native elected officials in the U.S. That number would need to reach 17,000 to achieve representational parity for Native Americans, who make up 3% of the U.S. population. Elon Musk's false or misleading post about the election, such as the claim that Democrats are importing migrants to vote, have generated more than 2 billion views on his X platform, according to the Center for Countering Digital Hate. The nonprofit found that Musk's election-related post, boosting Donald Trump and slamming Kamala Harris, were worth about $24 million in advertising. On the poll watch, 77% of American adults, including 75% of men and 80% of women, say women are as qualified as men to hold the highest office in government. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Molly Ivins. She says, "It is possible to read the history of this country as one long struggle to extend the liberties established in our Constitution to everyone in America." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.